Voilà, so let's go directly to meditation. In a spirit of loving kindness, to practice so that you may find greater happiness and actively cultivate the causes of happiness. And settle your body, speech, and mind in the natural states, and calm and soothe the turbulence of the conceptual mind, gently, breath by breath, with mindfulness of breathing. And for a little while, just let your awareness rest in the present moment, so effortlessly, just giving enough effort to release all grasping. That takes very little effort just to let go. And having let go, just rest in the present moment, in stillness, awareness resting in its own nature, knowing itself. Keep it simple. And if you have a sense of your awareness being located in your head, recognize that this too is simply a result of grasping. And see if you can release more subtly. And gently, gently let your awareness, the location of your awareness, the seat of your awareness, descend right down to your heart. Where your awareness is, there also is pristine awareness, primordial consciousness, your Buddha nature. They're not fundamentally separate. One saturates the other. So now calling on the luminous faculty of your awareness, symbolically visualize a radiant white light, an orb of light at your heart, symbolizing your Buddha nature or pristine awareness. Primordially pure, radiant white, of the nature of loving kindness and compassion, the wellspring of all virtue. Very source, the ultimate source of genuine happiness. You may visualize it like a crystal that refracts that white light into five-colored light, radiating out in all directions. And now drawing from your powers of imagination, imagine viewing yourself at this person in this room, this sentient being, from the perspective of your awakened awareness, pristine awareness, awareness that is lucid, knowing reality as it is. And viewing yourself within this dream we call our lives. From this perspective, call to mind or bring to mind any type of anxiety you have about the future, whether it's near-term, mid-term, long-term. Whether it pertains to anxieties about what you'll do after this retreat, or longer-term, of anxieties pertaining to your health, to aging, sickness, and eventually death, and what may follow. Whatever sufferings actually lie in the future, or you are anxious may lie in the future. Bring these to mind. What troubles your heart pertaining to the future? And imagine this too the suffering of the future like a dark veil, symbolically as a dark veil, a shroud, enveloping you, darkening your spirit, giving a heaviness to your spirit. With compassion for these many incarnations of yourself in the future, moment to moment, day to day, year to year, and lifetime to lifetime, with compassion for the person you will become and the troubles you will bear, with each in-breath, arouse the compassionate yearning. May you be free of suffering and the causes of suffering that await you in the future, or may await you in the future. May you be free of suffering and its causes, and with each in-breath, imagine drawing in that darkness into your heart and dissolving it there without trace. Imagine taking upon yourself the suffering of the future, taking this into the present, and dissolving it, evaporating it in this inexhaustible light at your heart. Breath by breath, imagine that darkness fading away, dissolving away. Breath by breath, imagine becoming free. Imagine the darkness gone. Imagine being free. Looking at a future of freedom. And now, as we turn to the cultivation of loving kindness, venture boldly, courageously, into this realm of possibility, that which has not yet become true, but may become true. Envision the future you would love to live, that realize your heart's desire, bring you the greatest sense of fulfillment. Use your imagination. What would make you truly happy? breath by breath, breathe life into that vision. As you breathe out the light from your heart, embracing and suffusing these future incarnations of yourself in this lifetime and beyond. And breath by breath, imagine realizing your heart's desire, finding genuine happiness and its causes. Now turn your attention to a dear friend, a loved one, someone who's going through a difficult time. Again, whether it's psychologically, or in terms of health, financial anxiety or distress, for any reason. Bring this dear person to mind and practice in the same way. and release all imaginations, all visualization, and all aspirations. And for just a short time, simply rest in the nature of awareness. Just a very quick question here. Who was it that asked about the Tibetan for merging mind with space? Was that Eric? Was it Andrea? Or is it somebody else read Tibetan? It wasn't Eric. It was you. You wanted to know the Tibetan? Okay. Or you? Oh, Selton, ah, lele. Because that you know. G-S-A-L and S-D-O-N-G. But I have a conscience, and when I gave the Tibetan for merging mind with space, I got a little bit wrong. So I checked, because I hadn't seen the Tibetan for a few years, and I hadn't memorized it verbatim. So I did check. And it's exactly the same words, a wording in the Vajra essence and the intent of Samatabhadra, and it is in Tibetan, Sen Chi Namka La Sepa. Sepa. So it's B-S-R-E-S. Yeah, Sepa. Which again means, it's Depa and Sepa have almost the same meaning. But that's what it is. So it's B-S-R-E-S-P-A. Sepa. That means to merge, to mix, to combine, to integrate the mind with external space. Okay? Hola, so. Hola, dadisoa. I don't like to mislead you. Otherwise, I could really derail you in your future lifetimes. He said depa, and it should have been sepa. Okay, today we move on to the third of the 7 points of the mind training. We're finally making some progress here. Yeah? And for some reason, I don't know why, but the auto-formatting in Microsoft Word here, which is the one I use, insists that it's number 2. And it's not. It's number 3. So there it is. And I can't fix it, because when I try to put in 3, then it throws everything else off. So what to do? The software has a mind of its own, and it's a bit derailed. But in any case, this third of the 7 points of the mind training is the first one being trained in the preliminary, the second one training in bodhicitta, having two parts, ultimate and relative. And now, really, now that we've laid the foundation in terms of ultimate and relative bodhicitta with the preliminaries, including shamatha as your foundation, now we're ready to look, okay, how do you follow Dumbha's advice? I'm going to tell my favorite story, probably my favorite story in all of Tibetan Buddhism. So it's a big one, and almost everybody here has heard it. Tough luck, you have to hear it again. And that is Dumdumba, previous incarnation of His Holiness. I keep on gravitating back to him. Dumdumba, the principal disciple of Atisha being the monk's monk, and Dumdumba in that lifetime being layperson. But he was out walking and he saw some, probably a monk, some practitioner, and he was doing circumambulations and probably reciting mantra. If he's like Tibetan nowadays, maybe a prayer wheel, his mantra. And so he's got his mala there, he's doing his devotions. And Domdrumba calls out to him and said, "Oh, I see you're doing devotions, circumambulations, mantra, prayer wheel. Very good. Of course, it's even better to practice Dharma." And this person, rather taken aback, he thought he was practicing Dharma, but he took it to heart because he has great respect for Domdrumba. And so he thinks about this, and then kind of the light goes on. Aha, of course. I've heard this many times myself. In the Gelupa tradition, especially, it said, better to go ti jita cha chen. In terms of debate, to really get an understanding of Dharma. Better doing that once than reciting 100 or 1,000 Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum is very good. But if you're doing it with no understanding of Dharma, it's a bit thin, right? So he had that thought. He said, I should be studying Dharma and not just, going around in ignorance, around the stupa. So he sat down and he's studying the sutras and the commentaries and so forth. Now he's doing it. Now he's really gone. He's really studying Dharma. Domdrumba comes along and sees him again. He said, "Oh, I see you're studying Dharma. You're really, cracking the books open and studying well. Very good. Very good to practice, to study Dharma. It's even better to practice Dharma." Again, he was taken back. Because a lot of monks spend years and years studying Dharma. If they're not practicing Dharma, then what are they doing? But again, he took it very seriously. And then again, the light bulb came on. He said, "Of course, what's the whole point of all that study? To put it all into practice and to meditate, to cultivate your mind, to liberate your mind." So now he's confident. So he sits down, starts to meditate. I imagine he's kind of keeping one eye open, waiting for Domdrumba to come along and congratulate him. Fine, it took you a while, but at least you got the right answer. So there he is sitting in meditation. And lo and behold, Domdrumba shows up. Right on call. He said, calls out, "Oh, I see you're meditating. Very good. It's even better to practice Dharma." And now the fellow really is at a loss. If it's not meditation, where's door number four? What else is there? There's devotional practice, there's study, there's meditation. What else? And so he asked him, how do I practice Dharma? And here's the line. He said, "Give up all attachment to this life and make your mind become Dharma." So that's what this next section is about. Transform everything that comes along, including adversity, into the path of spiritual awakening. Transform it, again, like an alchemist. Transform all the experiences, everything that happens to you, everything that comes your way for felicity and adversity. Transform it all into Dharma. And so, in dependence upon relative bodhicitta, with an explicit connection to relative bodhicitta, then the aphorism reads, "When the physical world and its sentient inhabitants are enslaved by vices, transform adversities into the path of spiritual awakening." So when you look around and you just feel resoundingly, wow, this really is a degenerate era. In terms of politics, in terms of business, there's so much corruption and greed and selfishness. In terms of the general people, so little ethics, so much unbridled. We go on and on and on, okay? And saying, wow, this is really a degenerate period. The world seems to be filled with vices. Just as the Buddha in the fire sutta said, the world's aflame. The world is aflame with craving, hostility, delusion. You look in all directions and you say, wow, pretty intense. This is where I was born. How did I get here? And so when that seems to be the case, like everybody seems to be enslaved by their mental afflictions and by the unwholesome or non-virtuous behavior that flows from that, transform. And so this means you're going to meet with a lot of unkindness, a lot of difficulty, difficult people, difficult situations, corruption, greed, dishonesty, and so forth and so on. And when that comes your way, then instead of doing the natural thing, "Oh, I've got some really difficult times now. I'm in financial straits, or I'm dealing with this difficult, my boss at work is really difficult, or the place I'm working is really awful, it's really stressful. This or that, or family problems, and this problems, and economic problems, and social problems. But man, when these are over, then I'm going to get to my Dharma practice. When I get, and I've heard this one, I can't count how many times, when I get more financial security, when I get some more money, then I'll get back to Dharma. I'm really looking forward to one day I'm really going to go into meditation and really meditate seriously. I'm going to go into retreat one day. But right now, of course, I've got to make money, more money, more and more money. I need better reputation. I need, but Dharma definitely when I can get to it, but not really right now. Well, so life passes. And if one does that, then really one's going to have hardly any Dharma practice at all. So in terms of commentary, in terms of a traditional approach, bringing in the Buddhist worldview, when one sees adversity coming one's way, misfortune coming one's way, then the first recognition should be simply to recognize here's the fruition of past karma, without feeling guilty about it, but just the sows were seen probably in some past life, maybe in this life, it does happen, sometimes very quick ripening, or we just do something obviously bad, and then we get the kickback, whether it's karma or not, we get, you know, cause and effect. And recognizing that this is the fruition of past actions, whether in this lifetime or past lifetimes. And when you think nothing can be done to remedy them, they arise as obstacles. And so there's how we get stuck. We reaffirm as misfortunes and then think we're helpless, exactly as in a non-lucid dream, where we're the victim of circumstances, we have nightmares, anxious dreams, fretful dreams, and so forth and so on, thinking it's all happening to us and having not a clue, not never even occurring to us that we're actually a full participant in this. We're not only an observer, but participant in this. And in fact, we have sown the seeds of the harvest that we are now reaping. And so to take that into account, and if that sounds very theological, very abstract, I can say beyond any doubt whatsoever that, it may be. It can be superficial and just kind of a belief you carry around in a satchel with no real power to it at all. Just, oh yeah, I believe in karma, whatever. And then that's just kind of like believing in the moons of Jupiter. I do, but it's never impacted anything I've done except for occasionally say, there are moons of Jupiter, but nothing else. It's just a little belief I have, right? Well, karma can be reduced to that, which means it's useless. But having lived with Tibetans from 1971 to 75, especially that period, when so many of them were so fresh out of Tibet, I mean, the catastrophe there, the genocide, was a very fresh memory, right? And I'm living in a refugee community, and it was poor. To see, and this is village people. I wasn't living with a whole bunch of esoteric, highly realized monks. I would meet them, but I was living in the village with village people. And it just really struck me very shortly after I arrived that although I'd come from a very fortunate background, just in so many ways, and hardly any hardship at all, I mean, in terms of external misfortune, I was just very, very fortunate. But it just really struck me when I was living in this refugee community of McLeod Gunj in 71 and through 75 that I'd actually never lived with such cheerful, warm-hearted, kind people in my life. And I mean cheerful, really very cheerful. Not all of them all the time, but nevertheless, you can make generalizations about a village. And this was an authentic, I knew it, because I knew what the first 21 years of my life were like. And I knew this, and I said, I've never seen this before. The warmth, the kindness, the friendliness, the lightness, the cheerfulness. And this is in a refugee community, you know. And so, you know, you check out how did you manage this? Because nobody got there an easy way. Everybody got there in a difficult way. And many of them, traumatic ways. A number of my teachers, Geshe Rabdin, Geshe Ngawen Taige, I think Gyatso Rinpoche also, they left in large groups, you know, fleeing en masse, like 100 here, 200 there. In many of the cases, like 90% of the people they fled with were shot. You know, they were killed en route. I mean, the Chinese communists would kill them on the way out, kill as many as they could. We're just trying to escape. And so many had been through that. And yet there they were, not just, you know, falling apart because of post-traumatic stress disorder, but actually the most cheerful people I'd ever met. And I'm just giving this rather elaborately. Is it because they'd achieved shamatha? Absolutely not. Or realization of emptiness? Or they'd achieved bodhicitta? Or they were really gung-ho, very strong meditators, you know. A few, sure, but not the general village people. They're busy making a living, you know, eking out a living. But it's their worldview. I think it's above all their worldview. A very deep, strong conviction in karma, so which then kind of lightens the resentment, the anger, and so forth against the people who happen to be the conveyors for the ripening of their karma, happen to be the Chinese, the People's Liberation Army, etc. But it clearly had a major impact on their lives. That belief that it's not fundamentally, absolutely their fault. The Buddhas didn't do it to us. God didn't do it to us. we've sown the seeds and now they're coming, so at least it's getting purified, and let's move on and make the best of the present situation. Really simple. But boy, it really worked. It really, really worked. You know? It really deeply impressed me. So when one takes that view of karma, that together with the faith in the refuge of the Buddha Dharma and Sangha, the faith in the lamas, the faith in the Dalai Lama, and these other wonderful lamas that were such radiant sources of inspiration. I mean, they're Jesus' beacons of compassion, of kindness, of good cheer, even in the most dire of times. They weathered that genocidal transition overall with just amazing grace, just extraordinary. And not all. I mean, I don't want to paint a rosy picture. I don't want to exaggerate. There's no need to exaggerate. There was this friend of mine I mentioned before when I told you about Kungo Barshi. It was probably in large part the impact of the genocide in Tibet that he really lost his mind and eventually committed suicide, the son of Kungo Barshi, who I knew. There was another one back then in the 70s. He was a medical student in the Tibet Medical Center. He just pushed too hard. He went crazy, kind of happy, silly, crazy. But he was definitely not in his right mind. And there were some others as well. There were a few others, but on the whole, quite extraordinary. So just that, really understanding the nature of karma, understanding the nature of refuge, these simple things that generally Tibetans do understand. They're not that complex or don't need to be uncomplex. But then bringing that into the view of reality. It's a major way that I saw this happen, you know. They really transformed adversity into the spiritual path. Many of them did. Especially with such leadership saying, feel compassion for the Chinese communists. Compassion, compassion, compassion. If you hold hatred, it will never serve you well. Just one more story. Kungo Bashi is one you already know. Ngawan Tundup, called Kuno. He took another name later in his life. Ngawan Tundup, he is a very close teacher of mine. I saw him just last year in Dharamsala. And he taught me Tibetan. He was one of my Tibetan teachers back in 71, 72. And remarkable man, very good man, extremely bright. And he was the youngest man on the mayoral council of Lhasa back in 59, 58. So young, very bright, well-educated, very devoted to Dharma. But he was there in Lhasa, March 10th, 1959, with the uprising there. And then the aftermath. He was there when the Chinese troops really came out and they were killing people en masse. They would even go, and Kuno told me this, he said he saw this with his own eyes. The soldiers would come into houses, into private homes in Lhasa, and they would see the women and children cowering there, and they just mow them down. You know, men had gone, they're off, they took off. The women, but just shooting them down, like right in their own homes. And he saw this, and it just filled him with rage. Just rage. And he had a gun in his hand. I don't know that he killed anybody, but he was there. He was not a monk. Of course, he escaped. But he told me, and he made this very public, but he told me for years and years and years, he could not forget. He could not let go. He said, there was just a hardness in my heart against those who had committed such genocide in our home. The violence, the bloodshed, the inhumanity of it. And he couldn't let go. He couldn't let go. And overall, very decent man, virtuous man, good man. But in his heart, he just, there it is, there's a symbol. He could not let it go. You know? Now, he's the official biographer of His Holiness Dalai Lama. Very close relationship. He lives in the Dalai Lama's compound. That's where I saw him this last year. And one day, he had a personal audience with His Holiness. One of many, I'm sure. Maybe it was to talk about the Dalai Lama's life and telling his biography. And His Holiness knew what he was holding on to and the burden it was for him. And I don't know the exact words. Kuno just told me that His Holiness just got to him. His Holiness got to him and said, you've got to let that go. You've got to let that go. It's only harmful. You've got to let it go. And he did. He actually did. You know. He just released it. And it was completely gone. Just released it. Said it. So acting out of mental afflictions. It's karma arising. I release it. So years ago when I was teaching at UC Santa Barbara, I invited him to my class to give a talk to the students. And students from multiple nationalities, including the Chinese students, quite a few there. And he gave a lovely talk. But at the end, I'm going to try to say this without breaking down, but at the end, and I was there, and I'm afraid if I say this, it's going to sound really sappy or cheesy or kind of silly. But at the end of his talk, he just said, I see that there are Chinese students here. I would just like to give you all a hug, you know? And it wasn't silly. There was nothing artificial about it. And they knew that. And he'd really released it. So he's an inspiration, one of my many, many teachers. The practices, it really practices. He turned it into the path. So, once again, but it's hard for me to tell that story without just really, it's tears of admiration and real reverence, actually. So, Geshe Chenghawa, going back to the commentary. Geshe Chenghawa, one of the great Kadamba Geshes, one of the great followers of Atisha, said, if you have the will to practice in the face of physical and mental suffering, they will become blessings from the object of refuge. So apply all sufferings to the two types of bodhicitta. So when we witness, there were some pretty strong examples right there, one very personal, one person that I know. And taking what was, how can we regard that as anything other than an absolutely awful adversity? I mean, the destruction of a civilization, the destruction of almost all their monasteries, the killing of up to maybe a million people in Tibet. Where's the silver lining on that cloud? How do you put a happy face on that, or do you even want to try? And it's just adversity, clearly. But then, as I mentioned earlier, for Kungo Barshi, he absolutely radically transformed it. And for Kuno, although he held on it for a long time, he was able to release it and turned it into compassion and really speak with the Dalai Lama. Our Chinese brothers and sisters, together with our Ethiopian and Indian and Brazilian and Argentinian and American brothers and sisters, that sense of kinship with everyone with no barriers, in which case, as you encounter adversity, including other people's harmful behavior, all of it turns into compassion, turns into bodhicitta. So, and then, of course, that can give rise just to an ever stronger, when one sees the extent of mental addictions and vices in the world, then it becomes just kind of all the more obvious. Wow, do we have a dearth of Buddhas in the world? We have too few bodhisattvas in the world. We should have a lot more. Morgan mentioned to me, I think this is not a violation of privacy, but he said, why don't we have more people like the Dalai Lama? Good question. Why don't we? Well, how many people are waking up every morning at 3:30 and practicing for 6 hours straight on top of a very busy day after that and have been doing that for 60 years? Maybe that's why. Gee, could it be? Of course, he had something of a head start. But nevertheless, he wasn't simply born that way by his own account. Whoever he is now, this is something he's been cultivating with very serious, dedicated, persevering practice for 60 years, more than 60 years, more like 65 years now, a very sincere, utterly dedicated practice. And if he were the only one, then he would say, okay, he's in a class all by himself. But in fact, there are really many remarkable men and women who just inspire. And then we say, aha, they were more or less like me. They practiced diligently. They turned out like that. And so the more one sees the extent of mental afflictions and harmful behavior in the world, the more this can inspire one for compassion. And then as one that becomes great compassion, I shall relieve your suffering. And then, okay, then I just have to become a bodhisattva for starters. And then launch on that bodhisattva path and be as effective and rapidly transformed as possible. The whole spirit of urgency in Vajrayana especially, looking at that three countless eons figure for the Sutrayana, you know, and saying that's a bit long, it's okay for me because I'll just have a whole bunch of good lifetimes for a long time. But for the sake of this world, which is in so dire need of enlightenment, of awakening, of wisdom, of deeper compassion, and just recognizing mental afflictions as mental afflictions, that might be a good start. and not just thinking it's human nature. Okay, so people get hateful and angry and mean-spirited and so forth, but after all, we've biologically adapted that way. What can we do? It's just human. And we're greedy and lustful and selfish and craving and have a lot of attachment. What can we do? We're just animals. We just biologically adapted that way. What can we do? It's just human nature. So we're arrogant, egotistical, and selfish, but well, what can you do? We're just animals and we biologically adapted this way. You just blew the brains out of your spiritual practice. You've given up all hope because you've reified mental afflictions and don't even see mental afflictions as mental afflictions. You see them as human nature, as if that's somehow hardwired. And that's a very common view these days. Manage your neuroses. Don't even dream about getting over them. And if you get psychosis, then you'll get some therapy and some really potent drugs. So transforming all of this into a deepening, broadening bodhicitta, relative bodhicitta. And in the midst of this, when we see how much corruption, how much evil and so forth there is in the world, it is ever so easy for all of us, very much, of course, including myself, to think, those are the enemies. If there's a political party you don't like, those people on the right wing or the left wing, that political party, this group here, this ethnic group here, this religious people of this sort here, the materialists over there, they're the real problem. Those materialistic people, they're the real problem, and so forth. This is all delusion of thinking the real enemies are out there and failing to recognize who the real enemies are. And the real enemies here in this context of the Lojong, you know it. It's self-centeredness and self-grasping. So self-centeredness, again, prioritization, one's own well-being being most important, and self-grasping, the reification of oneself, reification of others, and reification of the duality between self and other. And my hands always do that. I mean, it's just a really natural mudra. It looks like I'm about to punch somebody, right? But you're over there, and I'm over here. And never the twain shall meet, as we say. That is absolute division, absolute separation. Right? So those are the real problems. Those are the roots of one's own individual suffering. And then if one looks out, and this is not dogma. This is not something just to believe because the Buddha said so or Atisha said so. It's true or false, but this is something we really can investigate. When we look at the kind of troubles that the human-created troubles that beset humanity today, let alone through all of history prior to now, but just the current socioeconomic, environmental, political scene. There's so much suffering, some of it is human created, but instead of simply stopping there, it's this group, they're the bad ones. This group is the bad ones. Looking deeper and see, is it or is it not true that all that suffering stems from self-centeredness and self-grasping? True or false? And then in one's own life history, true or false, check it out for yourself. So, those are the true enemies, which means once you've identified them, then you have a real chance of actually eliminating them, you know, overcoming them. And we find so much of the terminology in Buddhism is the terminology of conquest. So arhat, you know, all know the term, an arhat, a person who's totally overcome all mental afflictions, for starters, craving, hostility, delusion, from the root, so that they never come back. Such a person is called arhat. In Sanskrit, and in Pali, in Tibetan, the term has the same meaning. In Tibetan, dajomba, a person who has conquered his enemies. A person is an enemy conqueror. That's what an arhat is. That's literally what it means. An enemy conqueror. Sounds like some kind of a muscular guy with an AK-47 and a bunch of hand grenades that, you know, just beat out everybody. But of course, the arhat has no weapons in hand at all, and the enemies that he's totally vanquished, totally conquered, are his own mental afflictions, his or her own mental afflictions. And Shantideva, this great bodhisattva, writing in his Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life, you know, all about the six perfections, generosity, ethics, patience, enthusiasm, meditation, wisdom, all good, good. And then you find this military terminology coming up again and again. Fighting the good fight, vanquishing the mental afflictions, being bold, be the courageous warrior, become a jina, a conqueror. That's an epithet of the Buddha. A jina is a conqueror, not only of your three mental afflictions and all their derivatives, but a conqueror of all types of obscurations that veil your Buddha nature. The conqueror, the enemy destroyer. And there's a lot more of where that came from. And so there's a spirit of it, of a boldness, a courageousness, without which, especially in a world like this, I think really one's practice will be feeble. If there's not courage, if there's not boldness, if there's not vision, then the world will be too much. And one's practice will always be like a cripple limping along from lifetime, from year to year, decade together, never developing that strength, that enthusiasm, that power, but always kind of feeling overcome by the heaviness of the world, the evil in the world. This is the medicine right here. So in order to do that, to identify self-centeredness and self-grasping as the true enemies, the core enemies, and then in terms of one's true friend, concern for others, benevolence, kindness, compassion, in order to overcome, now we need a strategy. Because when we really start investigating the impulses of our own mind, if your mind is at all like mine, you'll find that that self-centeredness is not only there for mundane stuff, but of course it can come right into your Dharma practice. In the practice of shamatha, for example, could your practice of shamatha be very self-centered? The answer is absolutely yes. Certainly it could. Or you're studying Madhyamaka philosophy, could that be self-centered? Definitely yes. Or you decide you want to become a Dharma teacher. Could that be an expression of self-centeredness? No question about it. Yes, absolutely. You know? And so it can be there in all that ostensibly, outwardly look like virtuous activities. It can all be driven by self-centeredness. In terms of a strategy for overcoming this deeply ingrained inner enemy that's going to be with us from lifetime to lifetime until we eventually banish it, skillful means. One strategy is take it layer by layer. Don't try to kind of eradicate it in all one fell swoop all at once. But recognize the extent to which, in our pursuit of happiness and freedom from suffering, to the extent that we are fixated on, let's say, the eight mundane concerns, on material acquisition, craving that, and then being averse to and fearing the loss of our stuff, our possessions, the seeking of hedonic pleasures, sensual, aesthetic, etc., and doing our very best to avoid anything unpleasant, seeking the praise of others, wanting to avoid ridicule, and then this much more generic one, very subtle and very, how do you say, really gets into our bones, maintaining a reputation, wanting to protect ourselves so people will think well of us, say good things about us when we're not there, and avoiding disrespect, aversion, etc., maintaining reputation. Insofar as our lives are oriented around those eight mundane concerns, that's our strategy. Those are the set of priorities to guide us through life, to find the good life, to avoid suffering. Or I like the simpler one as well. There's a classic one, the eight mundane concerns. But I like the simpler one too. That I've just been kind of teased out of just watching what's happening in the world. And I think it's kind of a shorter version. But the pursuit of wealth and everything that wealth can get you, and that's a lot. And then power or influence and everything influence can get you. And then fame, reputation, prestige, status, and everything that can get you. That's a lot. By the time you look, just not those three, but the things those three can get you. I think pretty much all the mundane concerns come into that. And if that's really where one's priorities are, that's one's strategy, then you're not going to be able to really touch self-centeredness. That enemy is there to stay because it's going to be guiding you. It's going to be the voice whispering in your ear, get this, get this, get this. You can get that. Beat that person out. You can get it first, and so forth. So there, it's layers and layers, but let's just looking at the eight mundane concerns. That would be a good way to start moving towards the final eradication of self-centeredness. Oh, that's an interesting one in the notes here. It's a question. And that is, can we trust that there is some power in the universe that will bring us what we need if we don't grasp after it with self-centeredness? And that is, and just as we move through life, trying to find good things for ourselves and putting ourselves first. You know, if there's competition, we're trying to run there to get there first. whatever it is, whether it's dharma, whether it's money, fame, power, whatever it is, oh, there's something good. And we run and try to get beat other people out first. If we take a step back, will we just wind up being total losers? Because everybody will say, oh, good, a schmuck. A schmuck, the person with no ambition, no drive. Good, push him out of the way. He's not going anywhere. And they all get it. And everybody else gets all the good stuff. I remember when I arrived, I flew from Germany to Egypt, from Egypt to Bombay when I was 21 with a one-way ticket to India and almost no money, just what I had in my backpack and a guitar, of course, and arrived in Bombay, and they said, where's your visa? And I said, visa? I was just coming from Germany. Germans didn't need visas. They had 3 months for free, and I was living in Germany. I never even thought, occurred to me, that maybe Americans aren't Germans, and I might need a visa. I'm 21. I said, I don't have a visa. And they don't have a visa. Well, then get out of the country. Where did you come from? I said, Egypt. He said, go back. I said, I don't have enough money to go back. It's a one-way ticket. So he was not pleased, the customs person. He just had me sit for a few hours. He didn't quite give me a dunce cap, but I kind of felt that way. And then he came and said, we'll give you a two-week transit visa. You have 2 weeks to get out of town, get out of country, and this is not extendable. So get out and don't come back, but you've got 2 weeks to get out. So I ran to Dharamsala. I flew to Delhi, got on the first train to Pathankot, took the first bus up to Dharamsala. Why on earth did I tell that story? Oh, yeah, I remember. In Delhi, I remember. In Delhi, I was taking this train. It was a 12-hour train ride from Delhi to Pathankot. And I took third class. There's nothing lower than that, third class. You remember third class. Who can forget third class? Indian train, 1971. And the train comes in, and there's just, it was kind of like all of India wanted to get on that train. And the platform was just packed. And the train stopped. And man, this rush of humanity just into these train cars. And I was told to have good manners when I was a kid, so I let everybody else get on first. Thinking, of course, there would be a place for me afterward, you know? Well, there wasn't. I wound up sitting, they had a toilet that you wouldn't want to be within 10 meters of on the train, and it had a door, of course, it swung open, and so the only place that was left when I let everybody else get on was the place on the floor where the door opened. So that's where I sat for a 12-hour overnight train ride. And every time somebody needed to go to the bathroom, then I had to move because they didn't open the door. So that was not quite a case of trying to put everybody before myself, but just kind of, I had been turned not to be pushy. And so that wound up being a really good story. But it's more seriously, that's kind of trivial. But more importantly, if one really does kind of loosen this grasping onto one's own well-being as being the top priority, will you not come out the loser? Because if we looked at this in a biological term, biological, evolutionary, will you survive? Will you be able to procreate? Well, the person who gets to the meat first, if you're a carnivore, most human beings have been, or gets to the vegetables or the fruit, the person who gets there first and gets it and then runs away so nobody can get it, that's the person who eats. And the person gets there second and sees a bare tree or what have you, they're the ones that may starve to death. Or they're not strong enough, they can't get a mate because they say, you're a loser, I'm not going to mate with you, I'm going to find somebody who can provide. You know, really raw, basic. And so are we really imperiling our very well-being? Is this so idealistic, so airy-fairy, that if we should actually be so bold is to release self-cherishing or self-centeredness? Is there any reason to believe that we won't just wind up being miserable and losers all the way through, never getting the good stuff, because we're always allowing other people to go first, cherishing them more than oneself? That's kind of a serious question. When one takes the issue seriously, then one sees, but isn't self-centeredness our best friend? Isn't it really our best friend? You know, the one that gets us there to the good stuff first before other people can get it. hedonically, you can be. You can wind up with more wealth. You can wind up with more power, that's for sure. In politics, if you have a really strong self-centeredness, could you get more power that way? Yeah, if you're skillful. And then greater reputation, could that be helpful? I think definitely yes. So self-centeredness could really help you with wealth, power, and prestige. And then once you've got those, if you're fortunate enough to get them, because no guarantee that self-centeredness will deliver the goods, once you've got them, then we can ask the other question. Now that you've got them, to whatever degree you got, the wealth, the power, the prestige. Are you happy? Are you happy? You've got all the external facade. You have all the symbols of happiness. People show you great respect. You have the great car, the house, etc., etc. You've got influence. You've got prestige. You've got all the symbols of the good life. And then you look inside. Is this a good life? Or is it just an empty facade, like an empty religious ritual where everything looks good on the outside and inside, nothing? So my strong hypothesis here is that self-centeredness may not always serve us so, that is the banishing, the release of self-centeredness, may not serve us so well in many occasions for our hedonic well-being. Actually, we may lose some. But then if I think of the happiest people I've ever met, right towards the top, are people like Gen Chamawandu. You must have known him, didn't you, Andrea? Gen Chamawandu. Happy guy? He can't even say it. Well, like, oh. He was just so radiant. He lived in abject poverty. Abject poverty. He told me at one point of his, I'm one of his disciples, and he told me at one point, with such much happiness, he said that there was a period when he had hardly any money, and he was just so focused on his practice that he would take a handful of brown flour, put that into one of the ceramic mugs, and then add hot water, stir it with his finger. And then he said, the hot water cooked the wheat. And he would, that would be his lunch. You know, thumbing brown flour with hot water. And he said it with such happiness. Or Genlam Rimba, who I lived with, and I'm also his disciple. I think I've told you, but that something like 2 years that he lived in Dalhousie when he went to train with an extraordinary master, Shalka Genyima Rinpoche, Genyima, and Teo Kyopan Rinpoche was there way back, late 60s. Incredible yogi, Milarepa-style yogi. So there's two. One, a superb scholar with very deep realization. His Holiness said of Shalka Genyima, he said, his wisdom is like the sun when it comes to realization of emptiness. And Teo Kyopan Rinpoche was renowned as absolutely Milarepa-style yogi. Incredible. So Genlam Rinpa, the younger monk, he really wanted to be training with them, to receive teaching from them, guidance from them. And so he moved to Dalhousie, a hill station about 2,000 meters up, really heavy rains. And then in winter, it's cold and wet. And there was no place for him to stay. There were no huts, not even any caves. But he found a rock, an overhanging rock. And for about 2 years, he lived under the rock. And then the American government was giving, maybe something like 10 kilos of brown flour to refugees. They just kind of send it out. And so he got on the refugee list. So he got, I think it was 10 kilos per month. And that was it. I mean, nothing else, but 10 kilos of brown flour. And so he would get his sack of brown flour each month and add his rock. And that was it. He had a house and he had food. And he said, he told me, those were some of the happiest years of my life. No worries, no concerns. Living under my rock, my little bag of flour, and receiving teachings from these incredible masters. So, hedonically, big loser, right? Big loser. In terms of genuine happiness, he won the lottery. He told me eventually, though, he wanted to come back to Dharamsala because His Holiness was there, his two tutors were there, and other great masters were there, this again in the early 70s. And he really wanted to come back there. I think maybe at least one, Teo Kyopan Rinpoche, had passed away. Genyima, I think, also came back to Dharamsala because I received some teaching from him there. But then he was a bit worried. He was worried for his future. Some of you are worried about your future. He was worried for his future. that if he went down to, back to Dharamsala, he would lose his security that he had in Dalhousie. You know, his financial security, his livelihood. Because he had a rock. And he had, 10 kilos of flour every month, and that was regular, he can count on it. But if he went to Dharamsala, he wouldn't even, he wasn't sure there'd be a rock. And he had no money for a house, a hut, a cabin, anything. And I've checked out the caves in Dharamsala. They're pretty awful, really pretty awful. You have to go up to about 5,000 meters to get a decent one. And that one's filled. It was by Losan Tenzin. He lived up there, 5,000 meters. He'd come down just once a year. I translated for him, another yogi, Losan Tenzin. And he was up there. Oh, incredible story, that one. But just briefly, he would come down just once a year from his hut up at about 5,000 meters. Not a hut, cave. He'd come down once a year when His Holiness was giving teachings, like around Tibetan New Year in February or so. And he'd come down to receive teachings and then get a bag of lentils and a bag of rice. And then traipse up the mountain again for the next year with his lentils and rice. So Genlam Rinpoche really had a dilemma in front of him. Shall I go back to Dharamsala where the greatest teachers are now? Really love to continue my training, continue meditating. But if I go there, my food line will be cut, because for him to have that refugee status, he had to stay in Dalhousie. If he went to Dharamsala, he's going to lose that. He's going to be out 10 kilos of brown flour every month, which means he has nothing at all. And so then he has no place to stay and no food at all, zero, if he goes back to Dharamsala. So, of course, he went back to Dharamsala. And he said, well, if I have to beg, I'll beg. I'm begging in a refugee community, of course. But if I have to beg for my food, I'll beg for my food. But that's where the great teachers are. And he told me he never had to beg. So this is a really, I could just keep on going for a long time. But I've seen this happen so many times. That if the total dedication is there to Dharma, the release of the fixation on the mundane concerns, as much as possible, the release on self-centeredness. My sense, what I've observed to be the case, and I've grown to trust, is reality rises up to meet you. You can call it the blessings of the Buddha, the blessings of the Guru, of Tara, whatever you like. But I've seen this happen time and time again. That hedonically, it may be a tough path. It may be really tough. Eudaimonically, tremendously enriching. And you can see for yourself. So, can we trust? Well, you take little steps into the shallow end of the pool and then see how it goes. Oh, lasso. I think I'll stop there, because there are some questions here that have been waiting. So we're ventured into transforming adversity into the path. So let's see what questions are. Oh, they really have stacked up a little bit. So this one I will read later, see if there's something I can do about it. Okay, very good, thank you. Hola, so this heavy-duty stuff, this arhat with remainder who commits suicide, they do not understand how someone with still a subtle form of self-centeredness can reach nirvana. Well, what can I say is, except for this is exactly what's said in the Pali Canon, and that is, you may be free of craving, hostility, and delusion, but self-centeredness is deeper than that. And so the Mahayana view is that if your whole route, if your whole path of spiritual practice is to achieve liberation for yourself so that you can be totally free of suffering yourself, experience immutable bliss beyond time, and never, ever, ever come back. That is the Shravaka ideal. It's not a judgment or an interpretation. That is the ideal. If you go to Thailand, Sri Lanka, Burma, you say, is this the Arhat ideal? To find your own liberation, to eradicate all mental afflictions, and to have a final rebirth and never ever come back, never be reborn ever again. Ask him, is that the ideal? The answer is, yeah, that's it. It's not a judgment. It's not putting it down. That is it. And then it's in the Pali Canon, again, not some kind of a slur from some outside tradition, that among those, and that's a minority, really a very small minority, of those arhats who then just saw, hey, there's only one thing keeping me in samsara, and that is this baggage left over from past lifetimes of this body-mind generated by karma and klesha, and I have no more klesha, and I'm not generating any more karma, so why should I hang on to this bag of rubbish, which is the only thing that's preventing me from slipping into immutable, timeless bliss of nirvana without remainder? And then they kill themselves. So there it is in the Pali Canon. And so how can one not view that as, are you not placing your well-being above everybody else's? Because, yeah, that gets you out of the little tiny bit of suffering, that physical distress, which is so easy to bear. But really, couldn't you have done something for somebody before you die, naturally? And so it may be difficult to understand, but there it is. So is not a form of grasping at the I a lack of realization of emptiness? No, that in fact they're not grasping at the I. Whether they have a realization of emptiness or not, well, different schools have different views on that, but are they grasping at the I? The answer is absolutely no. The ahamkara, it's called, ahamkara, grasping to the self. Ask anybody, Mahayana, Theravada, are they still experiencing grasping to the self? The answer is no. But do they exist conventionally, relatively? Is there someone there? If the arhat's name is Joe, hello, Joe, are you there? You're calling out to the arhat, Joe, are you there? Joe's going to say, yeah, here, what do you want? He's not grasping, he's not saying, yeah, I'm here. That doesn't mean he's deluded. He's saying, relatively speaking, there's a body and mind here upon which we designate the word I, Joe the arhat, and yeah, what do you want? So it's that conventional sense, not deluded at all. It's that grasping to even the conventional sense of self and the prioritization of that person's well-being over others. It's conventional. It's not delusional in terms of reification. But on that relative level, it's still a prioritization. If I kill myself as an arhat, then I'll have no more suffering at all. I just won't have to mess with samsara at all ever again. And why should I wait? And the answer is, well, you could help people before you go, for heaven's sake. But that doesn't occur. I don't know what else you would call that besides self-centeredness. It's a prioritization of my well-being over other people on a relative level without reification. So it's tough, I agree. Do you need to realize the emptiness of self to reach nirvana? The answer is yes. But that doesn't mean you realize you don't exist at all, because that would be nihilism. It means you realize the emptiness of kind of inherently existent or autonomous self. So it's difficult, I agree. But this is a Mahayana critique, and I have to say, I think it's a sound critique. And I think it's not limited just to arhats. I see other indications as well, that a prioritization on one's own liberation, and then kind of setting aside the notion that all sentient beings have been our mother, and so forth. Again, I want to emphasize this, and that is among the arhat disciples of the Buddha, some were tremendously compassionate and benevolent. A Buddha's own disciple, Ananda, and Shariputra, Moggallanaputra, and many of the others, Mahakasapa, and many of the others. I mean, they were just tremendously benevolent, kind, serving, dedicating themselves to the well-being of others. So it's not to say that arhats are simply selfish people. They're not. Some had greater loving kindness and compassion than others. There's a lot of variety there. But none of them had hatred. None of them had self-centered grasping or craving and attachment. But in terms of positive virtues, like compassion, loving kindness, there was a lot of variety. Okay? And those who seemed to have really not developed much in terms of loving kindness, compassion, they're the ones that took the knife. Right? So how does one display a rainbow body? There are three different ways. Three different ways of doing it. And I can't even remember whether I remember all of them. The most common way, and according to the late Pinhor Rinpoche, who was after Dujun Rinpoche, I think he was the head of the Nyingma order immediately after the passing of Dujun Rinpoche. Dujun Rinpoche being incarnation of Dujun Lingba. Pinhor Rinpoche, I didn't know him well, but I did translate for him just on one occasion in Los Angeles many years ago. And he was speaking to a group of about 300 people. I really struggled to translate for him. It was not easy. He spoke Kham dialect. But he commented at that time, and I was translating for him. He was about maybe 60 at the time, maybe 65. And this issue came up, rainbow body. And he said, I know with certain knowledge, I know it, that in my lifetime there have been at least 6 Tibetans who have achieved rainbow body, demonstrated rainbow body. I know that's the truth. And so what was he talking about? And this is cases where you have an accomplished Dzogchen master, man or woman, makes no difference, of course. And when they come to the end of their lives, then their body actually dematerializes, dissolves into 5-colored rainbow light. And in many cases, all that's left behind in terms of materiality is the part of their bodies that are no longer alive, and that is your hair and their nails. And that's all they leave behind. Okay? So it's called rainbow body because the body actually dematerializes. The physical stuff, the material stuff, the atoms, molecules, cells of the body, they are withdrawn into, dissolve into, the energy of primordial consciousness. They don't just vanish into nothing, but they're taken back home. That from which they emerge, that from which the universe emerges, the physical universe, emerging from Dharma Dhatu, emerging from the energy of primordial consciousness. Well, in this particular local case of the yogi's body, having utterly transmuted his mind, I'll just keep it to the masculine, having utterly transmuted his mind, dissolved his mind into substrate consciousness and his substrate consciousness into Rigpa, having already done that dissolution, then the body kind of follows suit. So he slips into the clear light of death and off into Dharmakaya, and he doesn't leave behind a decomposing corpse. That body that was saturated by his energy, by his awareness, that goes right back into the energy of primordial consciousness. And so what you see would be shimmering rainbow light and then gone. So there have been cases of that since the Chinese communist invasion and occupation of Tibet. Keeps on happening. I think the last one was about 10 or 12 years ago. Father Francis Tissot, Father Francis Tissot, a Roman Catholic monk, a priest, not a monk, but he was a disciple of an extraordinary monk, Brother David Stendelrost. He's still alive and very, very old. I wish I could meet him, but I doubt that opportunity will come. He lives in California, David Stendelrost, but an old and very benevolent, I think probably very saintly monk, Benedictine monk. And then Francis Tissot, Roman Catholic priest, is his disciple. And David Stendelrost has had a lot of engagement with Buddhists over the years. I think he must have met the Dalai Lama by now, but a lot of other Buddhists. And just one of those utterly benevolent, open-hearted, warm-hearted individuals who's just devoted his whole life to Dharma. In this case, happened to be Christian Dharma. And David Stendelrost, so Francis Tissot told me, he heard about Tibetan lore, Tibetan accounts of people achieving rainbow body, where their bodies dissolve, they're gone. But the most extraordinary case of rainbow body is called the Great Transference Rainbow Body. So there's kind of the so-called, I'll keep it simple, we'll just speak of 2 rainbow bodies. They're a bit more complex, but not much. Ordinary rainbow body. You just heard about that, right? That's ordinary. But the Great Transference Rainbow Body, Pochen Jalu, that's very rare in Tibetan history, Tibetan Buddhist history. Padmasambhava manifested it. Vimalamitra, who was a contemporary Padmasambhava, he manifested it. Chisen Senge Wonshuk, what was that, 12th century, he manifested it. And I think Matryakar told me of one other, and I don't remember the name right now, but one other in the history of 1,200 years of Tibetan Buddhism, one other yogi that manifested great transference rainbow body. Have you heard of any others? They're very rare, but there may be more, but probably not a lot more. But the great transference rainbow body, when you manifest that, when you're in perfectly good health. You don't die. That is, you're not dying of sickness, injury, old age, and like that. You can be in the peak of health, but when you see that your work is done, like Padmasambhava did, he saw that everything he could... Actually, he was invited to leave the country. I read this only recently. He was invited to leave Tibet because he really aroused the competitiveness of the kind of shamanic priests of Tibet. And they whispered into the king's ear, this guy's dangerous, this guy's dangerous. Look out for him, look out. You should probably give him a bunch of gold and ask him to leave. So the king offered him The king was finally persuaded. He felt, you know, I can't handle these guys. Okay, Padmasambhava, thank you so much. I'm sorry, but would you please leave? And here's a whole big bag of gold. If you'd just please leave. And Padmasambhava looked at the gold and he said, I don't need your gold. And he just kind of touched some, I don't know, some rocks or something nearby and turned it all into gold. That's how much I need your gold. I can turn anything into gold. But I see you want me to leave. And so, okay, no problemo. But instead of dying, or instead of just hopping on a mule and heading back to India, he manifested Great Transference Rainbow Body, where while in perfectly good health, he simply dematerializes his body. And it just goes into shimmering light, and it leaves nothing behind at all. So he didn't actually die. There was simply no sentient being there. And if there was whatever the materiality that might have been, that was just kind of a little effulgence that he just withdrew right back into its origin, back into the energy of primordial consciousness. So that's the other type of primordial consciousness. Excuse me, other kind of rainbow body, Great Transference Rainbow Body. So everybody, any Tibetan Buddhist who knows Tibetan history, know it's very, very rare. But I was really struck as I was reading these mind treasures of Dujum Lingpa that he presents this one as really as a live option. He said, do these practices. And he set so forth most elaborately in Vajra essence, more concise in the Atanta Samadabhadra, more concise in the Sharp Vajra of Conscious Awareness Tantra. And each time he says there's these different levels of rainbow body, and including Great Transformed Rainbow Body. And do these practices and you can achieve those. And Dujon Lingpa's biography has been now, his autobiography, has been translated, beautifully translated. What's it called? Crystal Mirror? But if you look up, you just go on Amazon.com or whatever you like to look at, Dujon Lingpa autobiography, it's come right up. I've read it. It's really a good translation. Extraordinary story. And in his biography, it tells at one point where, I think it was in a visionary experience, he was at the Wutaishan, the five-peaked mountain of Manjushri in China. And there he had a vision in which he received a prophecy that his teachings on Dzogchen would be of great benefit. They'd be tremendously beneficial in the cities of the West, in the future, in the cities of the West. That's what it said. And again, in more than one of his mind treasures, he makes it clear that these teachings that he received from Padmasambhava, he wrote down, he said, these are for people in the future. So I can't help it. I read that. Well, number one, I have to translate it. I felt really had no choice, you know. And I, of course, in each case, I've translated all five now, but in every single case, I went to Gyatso Rinpoche first. Because he taught me the Vajra essence, and he taught me another one, gave me the transmission and encouraged me to translate, which I did with Chandra Easton. Mud and Feathers, just for short, Mud and Feathers. So translated those two. But the other three, Buddha Without Meditation, commentary, Sharp Vajra Tantra, commentary, Intenta Samadabhadra, no commentary, but that one by itself. In each case, I went to him and said, I feel really, like I'd love to translate these if it would be beneficial. And what do you think? Shall I do it? Or let somebody else do it or not? Because, of course, I would do whatever he says. If he says, no, you're not qualified, or no, let somebody else do it, or no, won't be helpful. That would be the end of conversation. You know, okay, fine, no problem. But every single time he said, yeah, go for it, do it. So we're almost finished polishing. Wisdom will come out, all three together. So then you really have no excuse. If you don't achieve rainbow body, it's not my fault. Done all we can. And I'm just hoping that when those are available, that qualified lamas, teachers, Tibetan, non-Tibetan, will see, oh, it's available now. If I teach this, my students can actually study the text and not just have to hear me talk about it from the Tibetan and then have nothing to go to afterwards, but they can actually study this, practice this after the teaching is finished. And my real heartfelt aspiration is that this will inspire qualified teachers who have the transmission, who have the lineage, that they'll really start teaching them a lot more. Because you may not feel so inspired to teach a text that your student can't follow through it with it all because they can't read Tibetan and that's the only language it's in. So I'd love it if then they say, oh, good, that's available. Then why don't we start teaching it? And then when we have people in the modern era who are not born as tulkus and not necessarily Tibetan achieving rainbow body in the 21st century, then I figure, okay, Dharma is really alive still. We're not just telling stories from old times and bemoaning how almost all the great lamas have passed away. So, hello everybody listening to podcast. This is for you too. No excuses. Enjoy your evening. See you tomorrow morning.